Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 362, titled Networking Part 2, Enron, Saudi Arabia, and September 11th. And time permitting, we're going to, in addition to finishing up this document from John Loftus's website, we're also going to be reading a reply to a letter that John Loftus has sent to various sources on the Internet. Some very thoughtful insights into the nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and also allegations that the Palestinian side, as well as the Israeli side, of attempts to reach a peace negotiation were deliberately sabotaged by Saudi Arabia. John Loftus, himself, by the way, born an Irish Catholic from Boston, Massachusetts, has some very good insights into Islam as opposed to Wahhabism. We're going to be finishing up the second of two articles posted on John Loftus's website. That website, again, is www.johnloftus.com /enron1.htm/KNOW. Again, www.johnloftus.com /enron1. .htm/KNOW. By the way, this is being recorded on June 10th of 2002. We're going to be reading finishing up the second of two articles discussing an alleged relationship between the Caspian Sea pipeline negotiations, Enron allegedly conducting those negotiations on behalf of the various U.S. energy companies that were involved in the consortium to build that pipeline. That would include Unocal, and it also involved Saudi Arabia. According to this document, those negotiations helped to deliberately obscure, those negotiations were used to obscure U.S. intelligence agencies' functionings and public disclosure concerning Al-Qaeda, because indeed, apparently, Al-Qaeda was aware of the fact that U.S. intelligence services must have known about the Enron/Taliban negotiations, and that this permitted the September 11th attacks to go forward, because the fact that this was not getting discussed must have been known to Al-Qaeda. It is alleged here that the bin Laden family was going to be involved in the construction of that pipeline, and that, Saudi energy connection is one of the things that permitted Al-Qaeda, sort of like an AIDS virus, to infiltrate into the political bloodstream of the United States. We're going to continue with this article, and again, this is posted on John Loftus's website. There are two articles about the 9/11 connection to Enron and to the Afghan pipeline, and we're going to proceed from where we left off in Side 1. This is from Side 2. This is the second of the two articles. This is titled, The Enron Pipeline Connection to September 11th. Much of the Saudi information was blacked out of Bayer's book, that's Robert Bayer's book, See No Evil, from which we're going to read in a minute. Much of the Saudi information was blacked out of Bayer's book by CIA censors, but enough remains to thoroughly document the brazen avarice of senior Clinton NSC officials for a Caspian Sea basin pipeline. Bayer names a few names, but he was driven into retirement before he could learn too much. Still, he learned that both Republican and Democratic officials were involved with the pipeline cover-up to the great detriment of American intelligence. The worst condemnation ever written of the financial corruption in the Clinton administration can be found in the last chapters of Robert Bayer's recent book, See No Evil, where he blames the pipeline cover-up for substantially contributing to September 11th. Bayer makes a strong case, as do O'Neill's friends in France with their book. By the way, that book, The Forbidden Truth, was blocked for publication in Switzerland due to the effects of the Saudi investment company and Yaslam bin Laden. We talked about that in For the Record 355, The Ties That Bind, Part 2. Continuing. The explanation is raw and blunt. No partisan politics, just greed. A crooked handful of high-level officials in the Clinton and Bush administration were clearly obsessed with the Caspian pipeline plan. Cheney was not the first to block the investigations, but he is probably the last to be involved with the cover-up. That could explain why he is resisting Congress on both the Enron and pre-September 11th intelligence documents. If Congress ever connects the two investigations, the whole house of cards will collapse. Most of my sources say that Bush and Rice may have been deliberately kept out of the loop by Cheney. For example, it was Cheney, not Rice, who saw the Phoenix memo before September 11th. It is, however, theoretically possible that the president may have known about the pipeline deal from his own sources. President Bush's father was the leading lobbyist for the Saudis and may have been told everything by his Carlyle Group partners, the Bin Laden family, who were supposedly in line to get the Taliban pipeline construction contract. But it is doubtful we will ever know what Bush Sr. told his son while the pipeline negotiations were underway. In terms of the upcoming congressional investigation, the Al-Qaeda document is the first direct written evidence to confirm the existence of secret pipeline negotiations with the Taliban. Moreover, it confirms that Al-Qaeda was informed of these negotiations from the earliest stages. This raises an interesting question. The Al-Qaeda author, Mohammed Atef, must have known that his report had fallen into American hands when his operative's computer was captured by the FBI. Atef may have been surprised that his pipeline report was never made public to embarrass the Taliban. Atef may have suspected merely from the surprising silence that the FBI and the CIA were not being allowed to pursue or reveal their Afghanistan investigations while the pipeline negotiations were underway. The Saudis could certainly have tipped off the Taliban that the fix was in. It's hard to believe that the Bin Laden Construction Company did not learn anything from their Carlyle Group partners about the pipeline. Whatever the source, the early date of the Atef report shows that the highest levels of Al-Qaeda certainly knew about the pipeline secret from the beginning. The pipeline cover-up could have convinced Atef that Al-Qaeda could exploit the lack of coordinated intelligence against them. In addition to the usual interagency bungling, the Enron cover-up was the real reason for the black hole in U.S. intelligence about events in Afghanistan and plausibly explains why no U.S. agency was allowed to connect the dots. Moreover, it explains why honest officials like Baer and O'Neill were driven into retirement. Bottom line, Baer and O'Neill were right. There was a pipeline cover-up, and it very likely contributed to September 11th. The Atef report raises the founded suspicion based on specific, articulable facts that Al-Qaeda might have piggybacked on the Enron secrecy blackout to launch their surprise attack, confident in their knowledge that U.S. intelligence had been deliberately blinded by Enron's cronies in Washington. I think that is much of the story about September 11th. I think there is much more to that. Again, that authored, those two articles authored by John Loftus, available on his website at www.johnloftus.com/enron1.htm/no. K-N-O-W. I think there's also far more to that than just the Enron cover-up, though, if I could offer some supplemental insights to John Loftus's documents. I think, in fact, there is much more than just the Enron factor. I think that is part of it. I think that the energy business in general and the tangled web that has been woven by American covert power politics for more than 50 years has much to do with this as well. For the Record, Program 350, for example, talks about an interesting statement made by Sheikh Rahman that, quote, the one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years. I think there is some very important deep politics involved in September 11th that would go all the way back to what I call the Underground Reich, evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of François Genoux, the BCCI investigation, the October surprise, the Banco Ambrosiano scandal, and a great many things involving drug trafficking in connection with elements of the U.S. intelligence apparatus and that this collectively mandated the cover-up. Indeed, the New York Times of Sunday, June 9th, had an article by Judith Miller and Don Van Natta, Jr. This Dateline, Washington, June 7th, headlined, "In Years of Plots and Clues, Scope of Al-Qaeda Eluded U.S. And this reads in part, "Al-Qaeda's roots on U.S. soil," is this section. Mr. Bin Laden's name emerged in the FBI's investigation of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and was eventually included on a list of unindicted people who might be co-conspirators. But Al-Qaeda was never mentioned in the trials of the people behind the bombing or a related plot to blow up New York bridges, tunnels, and monuments. Terrorism experts now say that some of the militants who were later linked to these plots and to subsequent terrorist attacks aimed at Americans initially appeared in the United States long before the 1993 bombing. Government officials and analysts say the tentacles of what later became Al-Qaeda first appeared in the United States as early as 1986, the same year the CIA established its counterterrorism center to enhance the sharing of information among the CIA, the FBI, and other agencies that collect and analyze intelligence information. I would also add that the covert operation in Afghanistan was fully underway at that time, and as I've indicated in numerous past broadcasts, I believe that the motto, "Any bastard as long as he's anti-communist," attributed to Alan Dulles, has had much to do with the compromising of the U.S. intelligence apparatus in connection with September 11th and other things, and that indeed elements of what I call the Underground Reich associated with the Galen Organization and the Bormann Organization, and elements of the Islamo-fascist community, not to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there's a powerful fascist element within it that much of the Islamo-fascist community not only attached itself to, but ultimately doubled on the United States, much as the Galen/Bormann apparatus did as well. We're going to turn briefly now to the book alluded to in the John Loftus article. It's called See No Evil, subtitled The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War on Counterterrorism. It's authored by Robert Bayer, published in hardcover by Crown Books. By the way, that's a division of Bertelsmann. The ISBN number is 0-609-60987-4. It's copyright 2002. As indicated in the Loftus article, this book was heavily censored by the CIA prior to publication. It also, I think, can be relatively easily handicapped. This is not to say that there was not plenty of corruption in the Clinton administration. There, of course, was. But there are three branches of the civil government, executive, judicial, and legislative. Clinton barely got control of the executive branch. He only had a plurality of the vote in 2002, most people having voted for Bush or Perot. He then had the legislative branch was controlled by the Republicans for six of his 8 years. Two-thirds of all seated federal judges when Clinton took office were appointed by Reagan and Bush alone. And federal judges served for life. Clinton seated eight of 114 judicial appointments. And when one factors in on top of that, hostile media and national security establishments, one basically has a little more than a surfer riding the wave. And again, this is not to say that Clinton was without sin, but he really was without a presidency, and one should note that. Nonetheless, this book, for its obvious shortcomings and for all of its handicapping, is a very important work. The book See No Evil, The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War on Terrorism, has some interesting things in the epilogue. Speaking of Bayer's work as a consultant in his post-CIA career, "More interesting, among the clients we attracted, and I use the word advisedly, was a member of a Gulf royal family who was then living in Damascus, having tried unsuccessfully to overthrow his cousin, who was the emir. We would meet him irregularly at a desert location between our office and his home, and one night in December of 1997, as we sat huddled by a fire to hold off the night cold, he told us this story. When he'd been working as chief of police in his government, he had become aware that his government was harboring an Osama bin Laden cell. The two main members of the cell, he said, were Shawky Islambouli, whose brother had assassinated Anwar Sadat in 1981, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, whose area of expertise was airplane hijackings." By the way, I'm going to interrupt briefly to read from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, June 5th, or rather Wednesday, June 5th of 2002. This is an article by Josh Meyer of the L.A. Times. There was much coverage of this story. It's headlined, Key 9/11 Planner is Named. Inquiry, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was probably the mastermind of the attacks, officials say. The lead two paragraphs. U.S. intelligence officials believe they have identified a mastermind of the September 11th attacks, a mysterious Kuwaiti already wanted for his alleged role in a 1995 plot to bomb a dozen U.S. airliners over the Pacific Ocean, authorities said Tuesday. Quote, it looks like he's the man, quite honestly, unquote, one Bush administration official said of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, a key lieutenant to Osama bin Laden. Keeping that in mind, and beginning this last paragraph again in Robert Bayer's book, when he'd been working as chief of police in his government, informant, he had become aware that his government was harboring an Osama bin Laden cell. The two main members of the cell, he said, were Shawky Islambouli, whose brother had assassinated Anwar Sadat in 1981, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, whose area of expertise was airplane hijackings. The prince went on to tell us that when the FBI attempted to arrest Mohammed and Islambouli, his government had equipped them with alias passports and spirited them both out of the country. Both eventually settled in Prague. Getting out of the spy business proved a lot harder than I thought it would be. As if I'd never left, I passed everything I had learned from the ex-police chief back to the CIA in early 1998. Not surprisingly, there was no follow-up and no response. Skipping down. It wasn't until 3 years later, in the early summer of 2001, that an associate of my prince, a military officer still working for his government, informed me he was aware of a spectacular operation about to occur. He also claimed to possess the name of Osama bin Laden operatives in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. He provided us with a computer record of hundreds of secret bin Laden operatives in the Gulf. In August 2001, at the military officer's request, I met with an aide to the Saudi defense minister, Prince Sultan bin Abdulaziz. The aide refused to look at the list or to pass them on to Sultan. And in that regard, I would also note, in August of 2001, was when Jeffrey Skilling unexpectedly resigned as the chief executive of Enron. Financial Times, the weekend edition of June 8th and June 9th of 2002, greed and fear return. As the bull market recedes, evidence of misbehavior by U.S. chief executives is growing, finds Andrew Hill. There's a timeline of the decline of the U.S. stock market, and it notes, August 14th, 2001, Jeffrey Skilling unexpectedly resigns as chief executive of Enron. That would have been just as the pipeline deal was allegedly collapsing. So very, very interesting indeed. And for the duration of the broadcast, I'm going to read a letter that was put in a reply letter by John Loftus about some of the Saudi dealings vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian question. Also has some very interesting insights about real Islam, so to speak, versus Wahhabism. Loftus writes, for 20 years I have served without compensation as a lawyer for federal whistleblowers within the U.S. intelligence community. In the last year, I have received highly classified information from several of my confidential clients concerning a Saudi covert operation. The Saudi relationship is so sensitive that for more than a decade, federal prosecutors and counter-terrorist agents have been ordered to shut down their investigations for reasons of foreign policy. I am filing a lawsuit in Hillsborough County Court to expose the manner in which Florida charities were used as a money laundry for tax-deductible terrorism. The complaint cites specific testimony, including highly classified information which has never been released before. Simply put, the Saudi government was laundering money through Florida charities run by USF Professor Sami Al-Arian for the support of terrorist groups in the Middle East. Through the Al-Arian network and others, the Saudi government secretly funded Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad. The Saudi purpose was twofold: the destruction of the State of Israel and the prevention of the formation of an independent Palestinian state. Two particular terrorist groups, Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, were specifically chosen and funded by the Saudis for their willingness to undermine Arafat's Palestinian Authority. The secret Saudi goal was to create such animosity between Israel and the Palestinian Authority that it would wreck any chance for the creation of an independent Palestinian state. Their tactics specifically called for the intimidation or murder of those Palestinians who were willing to work with Israel for peace. To put it bluntly, the covert Saudi network in Florida funded the murders of fellow Muslims for the crime of wanting to create the first democratic Arab state. Whatever harm the Israelis may have done, they did build an excellent, they did build an excellent public education system, including several universities, for the benefit of their Palestinian neighbors. That was the problem. While literacy in the Arab world is below 50%, in Israel it is 97%. Israel is the only place in the Middle East where an Arab woman can vote. After 50 years, Israel has created the first Arab class exposed to democracy, literacy, and Western values. To the Saudis, a democratic Palestinian nation would be a cancer in the Arab world, a destabilizing example of freedom that would threaten Arab dictators everywhere. As King Fahd said, quote, "Next to the Jews, we hate the Palestinians the most," unquote. The harder the Israelis and Palestinians worked for peace, the more money King Fahd poured into his murder-for-hire program. The Saudi government has already begun to spin its operations, claiming that this terror network was a rogue operation financed by a radical Saudi businessman without the support or knowledge of the Saudi government. The truth is that many of the Saudi princes, notably Prince Bandahar and Prince Al-Walid, are good and loyal friends of America who want to lead Saudi Arabia into the modern world. Unfortunately, they are now in the minority in their own country. King Fahd is on his deathbed, and his nephew and heir apparent, Crown Prince Abdullah, depends on the most radical southern and eastern clans for his political base. The southern faction is the center of popular support for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban because it is the home of the most extreme Muslim sect, the Wahhabis. 99% of the Muslim world rejects the Wahhabi religious tenets as utterly repugnant to the teachings and examples of the Prophet as written down in the Hadith. That's spelled capital H-A-D-I-T-H. Since most Wahhabis are functionally illiterate, they cannot read about this conflict on their own. Typically, they memorize a few passages of the Quran taken out of context and never read the accompanying Hadith for explanation. And I would note here the contrast between John Loftus has to say and the traditional views of Muslim views on a number of different things. I think this is a far more educated and insightful and enlightening view of Islam than is generally being passed around in this country. And I think that people of good heart and good faith and integrity, be they Christian or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus, should not only think very carefully about what I'm about to read, but should make a point of educating others about this and factoring this in to the highly charged and dangerous rhetoric that is being kicked around. That's one of the reasons why I've made it a point for some time to differentiate between Wahhabism and the rest of Islam, and it's one of the reasons why I've characterized Wahhabism as Islamo-fascism. It also has very strong connections to the international fascist community and what I've called the Underground Reich. Loftus goes on to say, for example, the Wahhabis are taught by rote that Jews are subhumans who should be killed as a religious duty. In contrast, the Hadith explains that the Prophet Muhammad honored Jews, married a Jewish wife, forbade forced conversions of Jews, always bowed in respect when a Jewish funeral passed, and promised that good and faithful Jews would go to paradise just as good Muslims and Christians would, and that the Jews would have their holy place in the West, meaning Jerusalem, while Muslims would have their holy place in the East, meaning Mecca. Illiteracy is a weapon of oppression. The Saudis and their Wahhabi proteges, the Taliban, have decreed that women cannot work or even sit in the front seat of a car. In contrast, the Hadith records that the Prophet worked for his wife and that she drove her own caravans in international commerce. The Prophet forbade racism. The Wahhabis practice it, especially against their non-Arab Shiite minority. The Wahhabis, both in Saudi Arabia and the Taliban, discriminate viciously against women. The Prophet, who lovingly raised three daughters, insisted that women should have substantially equal rights in contract, ownership, and divorce. The Muslim faith envisioned by the Prophet in the Quran and recorded by his contemporaries in the Hadith is a religion that practices tolerance toward all races and religions, stresses the extreme importance of literacy and education, and elevates the status of women to unprecedented levels in many societies. This is the gentle, peaceful Muslim faith practiced everywhere in the world except in Saudi Arabia and the Taliban provinces of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Muslim scholars speak derisively about the primitive Wahhabi apostasy, but rarely in public. The reason for this deafening silence is simple. Most mosques in the world are impoverished and depend upon Saudi subsidies for their operation. In return, however, the Saudis have gained a foothold for proselytizing and radicalizing the Muslim youth through religious education in the form of militant Wahhabism. Children learn to hate because they are being taught that way. The Saudi charitable network in America that began with religious education evolved into other areas over the decades. The Saudis dabbled with funding anti-Semitic hate groups as a means of breaking down American support for Israel. After the fall of communism, the Saudis took over funding the most militant terror organizations for direct attacks against Jewish and Palestinian supporters of the peace process. Year after year, members of the intelligence community warned that a rising wave of terror was coming. Oliver North wrote in his autobiography that every time he tried to do something about terrorism, he was told to stop it because it would embarrass the Saudi government. John O'Neill quit his job as head of FBI counterterrorism for the same reason. Jonathan Pollard went to jail. Federal agents in Tampa, who had known about the Saudi Sami al-Aryan connection since 1990, were ordered to drop the investigation in 1995. The Saudi influence buying machine had effectively shut down any threat of criminal prosecution. Those Americans, including a former president who lobbied for the Saudis, have a lot to answer for. So do the Saudis. With the explosive growth of Al-Qaeda and their Taliban allies, the Saudis finally recognized that they had gone too far. As Osama bin Laden laughingly related on videotape, he was approached prior to the attack on the Twin Trade Towers by his relatives, who offered him $300,000 to cancel the operation. Apparently, the bin Laden family really had not broken off all ties and knew exactly what was coming. So, my clients say, did the Saudis. 6 months later, a much-chagrined Prince Abdullah belatedly announced that the Saudis would release the names of the terrorists which their charities had unwittingly, unquote, funded, but only in Somalia and Asia. The main Saudi charities in Herndon, Virginia, and the Al-Aryan Network in Florida are still untouched. My clients are betting that the American influence peddlers hired by the Saudis will succeed once again in derailing a federal investigation. They came to me for help in exposing the cover-up, and that is why I am filing this lawsuit. In the months to come, the American public may finally begin to learn why the Saudi Sami al-Aryan terror networks went untouched for so long. It wasn't an intelligence failure. It was a foreign policy failure. The orders were not to embarrass the Saudi government. Year after year, the cover-up orders came from the State Department and the White House. The CIA, the FBI, and the Justice Department just did what they were told. No one intended the harsh consequences of letting the Saudis get away with it again and again. Only after September 11th, when the Treasury Department found the financial transactions linking the Saudi charities directly to Osama bin Laden, did American officials realize the extent of their betrayal. We are not alone in our grief and anger. Saudi money sabotaged every Israeli initiative to make peace. The bewildered Palestinians may finally realize that they have been stabbed in the back by an Arab brother. The rules have changed after September 11th, but the bottom line remains the same. If we want to stop terrorism, we have to tell the Saudis to stop funding it. And that again, authored by John Loftus. I guess one could only say it on the circumstances that may the force be with John Loftus.
I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.